Hello.
Actually, the first when we, I first moved into this house, I recorded an episode in the wrong room, like for the acoustics, and it was so god awful
Had to record the
that I
whole
had
thing,
to record the whole thing
yeah. That's
all over
so
again. It was
annoying though,
so
because you have to get in the right
yeah.
Yeah,
thing,
and
exactly.
it's so defeating when you realize you have to record it again.
We've learned now we record one section and then he listens. I don't.
Yeah,
Oh, smart.
We don't ever record the entire thing all at
Smart.
once without stopping. But ours are, you know, they're scripts. They're like, you know, a couple thousand words divided up
Per,
into
right.
chunks.
So I'll
So
just read the chapter now, guys, right?
Read alive.
I have it open
here.
So.
Did you both read it, or are you just going off of?
No,
I already know.
Read it
not
last
only
night.
did we
Okay.
both read it, and I made some notes, and then, you know, we just covered this in our previous
episode.
We're
all
and actually we haven't even done the Sam live stream yet. That's actually like in a couple of weeks.
Ooh, so this is a little interlude
like
between
Samwell immersion. Yes,
and we're just going to mostly talk theories, I would assume. I mean, I just have a lot of questions for everybody. So whether or not you read the chapter,
I really liked this chapter a lot. Really liked it.
Yeah,
I felt like it.
Are we recording?
Yep.
Oh, cool. Okay, sorry.
I felt like it was a. Quintessential in a way that I was like, okay, that felt like this was made for me. And I know it wasn't, but it's cool when stuff makes you feel like that.
Yeah. It was made for you.
Was it really?
For you?
This is
and me?
Not helping
and
my paranoia.
Well, I feel like it deals with so many of those questions that you care about. So, like, it deals, there's so much, some like the underlying magic is coming a little bit more into play in this chapter. And so, which I think is right up your alley.
Isn't it cool being outside of a place? And then now you're tucked deep inside of the place. He goes from coming in on the cinnamon wind to here's where you're now going to sleep.
Yeah.
I don't know what you would call that. That just scenario
yeah.
to me is cool. It's just we didn't have the same with Arya went to Braavos. And it's a similar sort of ride up situation through the harbor, looking at the Titan, seeing the different ways, the channels, which way the water went, getting establishing architecture, and understanding the area so much more.
Yeah.
But she just got to the front of the House of Black and White. There wasn't a lot of welcoming aspect, but Sam here has really been like welcomed in and sort of a fast track into the order. And at first, when you're going into the chapter, it feels like he's going to talk to Theobald or whoever the seneschal is at the time.
Yeah.
And he's going to have to, it'll probably just be him speaking his case. That'll be the end of it. But
yeah.
What a cool way to end the book for it to be a flurry, a whirlwind of actually, it's kind of like the feeling where Ollie in the TV series where Ollie's like, Benjen's here, come out into the yard. Just a flurry of stuff happened at once, except he doesn't get stabbed.
Right.
But it does end with Pate. So he still did get us while he gave us that whirlwind of excitement of Marwyn. Snapping into action immediately, he calls him Slayer.
Yeah,
come on, Slayer, come in. Just it's all happening, a whirlwind of action. How dare you, sir? And but then again, like I said, then there's Pate at the end where now where it's like, oh, can we really be that happy? Because we don't know. I don't know if it's actually a safe situation for him to be in or not. What do you guys think?
I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily a safe situation for him to be in, but it feels. We've been waiting for so long for Sam to get here, and it feels familiar to him. This is kind of the thing. I mean, we hear in the beginning of the chapter, as he arrives, he's like, why didn't I come here earlier when I was a kid?
Right.
This is kind of where I belong. And so there's that sense of, and it's near his family home, so there's that sense of familiarity, I think, that even if the situation is a little bit dangerous, people are actually listening to him, and it's a place that he's always wanted to be in. And so there's that familiar comfort, I think, almost, that he finally made it.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's grown on this journey. He was at the wall and he was sort of the butt of people's jokes for a long while. And he's, you know, he's Fat Sam. And then he goes on this journey and he sort of gets to change a bit. You know, he gets the space. And now we're entering the phase where we can, you know, see how that manifests. And he might be feeling a bit more confident than he was. And, you know, it mentions that his clothes are looking big on him, meaning that he's been eating a lot of fruits and he's looking a bit different. You know, the changes are physical and I think mental. And I think we're arriving at the Citadel. He's got a chance to grow even further now. So
I was amazed rereading it and thinking about the way he he's when he gets there and he's thinking about what to do with Gilly, and he thinks, you know, is it going to be safe for her here? Should I send her back on the Cinnamon Wind? Should I bring her to Hornhill? And he goes through this whole decision-making process, and it's all very mature and confident. Mm-hmm. It is 100% not the Sam from Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. who would have been scared of everything. And he decides that he's going to bring her to Hornhill himself, and he's going to go to check it out and make sure everything's safe. Like, he doesn't trust other people to take care of her, which is such a big change. And, you know, if she's not going to be safe there, he'll bring her back to Old Town. He's just so different, more confident in everything that he does. I mean, to be confident that he can actually care for her and protect her from mm-hmm. some dangers is 100% different from where he was, you know, just a few months ago.
He's Sam the Slayer. He refers to himself as that, which I loved that moment when I know. He's like, they call me Sam the Slayer.
I don't know why I said that.
Why are you saying that? You hate that.
Come in here, Slayer.
Yeah. Like, now you're saddled with it forever.
Right.
So you can see it as a sort of manhood arc that's unfolding, you know, before our eyes. And, you know, these tests, like you say, Zach, he gets pulled into immediately into this kind of thick plots that are going on in the Citadel. And, you know, it was a feint when he arrived there, and it seemed like, oh, this is going to be a bit slow and dull, and the guy wouldn't let him in for a while. And it, you know, it changed very quickly into a bit of an adventure. So, you know, I think we've got lots to look forward to in future Sam POVs at the Citadel. It's definitely not going to be boring or just sort of laborious. It's going to be exciting and perhaps even thrilling.
I think it's going to be, I haven't really been thinking about it enough, but reading this chapter and re-visualizing the dragonglass candle burning in the center of the room that he's just walked in, and knowing that this is where he's staying. They have it lit. They figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
Marwyn's, I'm assuming, in control of the whole situation. It sure seems that way. But judging by the people that he's surrounded by, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I really don't know what's going on. It's left to be a little bit confusing. But if he leaves, and it seems like he's leaving, and Sam's there to just do his thing in Old Town and give us a new set of chapters with a new goal. Mm-hmm. Holy crap.
I know.
It's very exciting.
Holy crap.
Everything happening, all the inklings of Euron as he's kind of slurking his way around the outskirts of coming into Old Town and all of the kind of understanding of some of these magics coming to light and the drama of what is or isn't allowed to be talked about in the Citadel, and kind of what science versus magic and dragons and all that kind of stuff coming to light. He's at the center of action, which almost seems strange because he's so far away, but this is kind of at the center of everything.
Yeah, it really is. I found, like, so the sort of the end of the chapter when he gets there and he meets Alaris, and he meets, well, eventually Pate and Marwyn and Leo. It's, I said when we talked about this recently in an episode, it's like the assembling the team trope. So it's almost like it's going to be like a kind of a buddy adventure.
Yeah.
You know, like whatever happens next, I feel like it's going to be that group of people. And I think we're stuck with Leo Tyrell. I think he's going to be part of the group. He's going to be like that guy that everyone's always like, oh my God.
It wasn't that bad.
How did we get this guy? And hey, what, you know, like, what's even happening with him? Like, you know, are they going to end up down in the bowels of the Citadel looking for whatever it is, Pate, Jacket, quote, whatever?
Unquote. I was going to ask, what do you guys think about Pate? What do you guys think about Pate? Who is Pate?
Pate is Jacket.
Pate is Jacket or just a faceless assassin?
I think he's definitely Jacket because he looks like the way Jacket looked at the end of the last time Arya saw Jacket, and he changed. The description is
there's a hooked nose.
Hooked nose, the red.
Was there a scar on his face or something that, you know, you could be pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. The descriptions are so similar.
So is this a job or is he gone rogue?
Well, that's a good, interesting question because how would he know? Like he's in the Black Cells. Like whatever was his agenda in the first place. Mm-hmm. He started out in King's Landing in the Black Cells, and then he was going to the wall, and then he wasn't, and then he ends up in Old Town. So I'm not really sure.
And he knows a lot enough to want to be here, to mm-hmm. be this close to Morrowind.
Yeah.
And he also recruited Arya. So if you're thinking, has he sort of gone rogue? You got to remember that he
did send her.
He sort of sent Arya to the House of Black and White. So maybe rather than going rogue, he's someone with a lot of license to go and investigate things and report back to, you know, the head honcho at the Black and White or however that organization works.
Do you think it's possible he's the head honcho?
Do you mean that he's actually the kindly man, like time wise, or that the kindly man isn't really the head honcho and that Jaqen is?
It's hard to say. I didn't ever really think the kindly man was the main person, but it would make sense because he's at least high up enough to sort of filter out who comes in.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jaqen has to be, well, I wouldn't call him that for lack of knowing anything real about him. He's got to be pretty high up because of all those things we were just saying.
I mean, exactly,
he clearly had multiple missions mm-hmm. that he could deploy. I mean, unless he has, well, it seems unlikely that he would have a glass candle in his back pocket, given that the Faceless Men probably don't approve of that.
Right.
But
seems useful though.
Yeah. But it's Valyrian. So they would not probably.
So they're just anti any sort of Valyrian technology at all.
I think so, because that's how they, you know, Braavos was very anti-Valyria. They were free escaped slaves
exactly.
from the Freehold.
Especially
so
dragons.
I think,
though.
You know, dragons, but I would assume that also any Valyrian sorcery is kind of like...
Them being suppressed, you know, you'd assume that they would be anti.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
So how is he communicating? I mean, does he just have like a laundry list of things that he has to do in his back pocket? You know, like, oh... Got to go to King's Landing for some reason. Got to go to the wall. Oh, that's not going to work out. Go recruit Arya Stark. Done that. Now I got to go to the Citadel.
On to the next.
You know?
Like, how does it all fit into the same kind of mission? Or are they all
Is it all
separate things?
Related? Is it all a bunch of separate things that he was supposed to do?
And now why is he patiently sitting in Marwyn's study?
Well, Marwyn seems
office.
To be kind of the guy who he... knows a lot. He mm-hmm. sees a lot. I mean, he has this glass candle that gives him access into people's dreams and events and things that are happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, he kind of seems to me like the sit back and understand everything that's going on and whether or not he's manipulating that mm-hmm. or he's just taking in a lot of information, what the purpose of all that is. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But I think somebody like Jaqen, who seems to be trying to play the game is the best he can. Marwyn is a guy to be close to because he's got power and knowledge and all the resources seemingly that you might need in order to be successful.
And his knowledge is the underground sort. It's not, he's not a typical maester. And, you know, it shows it at the end of the chapter. Jaqen really hits the jackpot. Sam comes and tells everything that's been happening at the wall the whole journey. Daenerys, the dragons, all in one go in the space of 5 minutes.
Twice.
Jaqen knows everything.
So if the Faceless Men are, you know, if their goals sort of intersect with the Citadel and that they want to eliminate dragons because they're a danger to the world or what have you, he just did. I mean, he found out where the dragons are, what they're doing from Sam, but he also has this glass candle, which he can use to kind of like track the dragons or find out any number of things that will help them, you know, in their goals. And even if I assume if they don't approve of that technology, I mean, they probably wouldn't be above using it.
It's useful
for their end game.
Yeah.
You know,
and
whatever
they're
that
so
is.
Separated from their lineage. It's been so long. They weren't treated as badly as the people that came before them.
Yeah.
Surely they can separate it enough to be like, maybe I'll use this candle.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't know if it's all about just making sure the dragons don't come to power. I just don't know.
Well, there is a fan theory that Jaqen is in the Citadel to get hold of the Death of
Dragons,
a book that I think Tyrion mentions. That it's called The Death of Dragons.
Maester
and
Tomac.
It teaches you how, you know, the weak spots of dragons and how to kill them. So that there is a theory that Jaqen is there trying to get his hands on this sort of ancient tome.
And that would be the reason why he's
sought there
the
in
key.
The first place. And then he's sort of spying and seeing what information he can pick up, remembering that the faceless men make great spies and they get whatever information they can.
So he's about to score this book, The Death of Dragons, but in the meantime, he's also found out exactly where the dragons are. So they're like...
Apart from the I don't know if you would call it a... What's a very common term when people are prejudiced? Apart from the prejudice. Sorry, I'm not prejudiced.
Well, you gave no info on what you were trying to think other than it was a common term.
I got there eventually.
Couldn't help.
Grass.
What's that apart from prejudice of the reason that they were founded and from within the freehold, the order of the assassins of the House of Black and White and the guild that they created, apart from their rough past with people who use dragons as their steeds or as their magical friends and consorts, et cetera, artistic representations of their houses. Apart from all of that, what reason do you think that the House of Black and White would want the dragons to go away? Is it just to make sure that they retain power in the way that they continue to do it? Or are they working for someone else? Maybe they've been hired by the Iron Bank or something?
Yeah. I mean, just to keep that
big
balance
contract
of power, you know, from not shifting to somebody with magical nuclear weapons, you know, I mean, and that's such a great comparison when you talk about dragons, you know, to put it in real world terms. I mean, what do world powers do to prevent rogue nuclear weapons, you know, in this world? They'll probably do just about anything to keep, you know, that from happening. So, you know. Right now, Danny's got, well, two dragons that are basically rogue nukes.
Yeah.
Just flying around
in the reading
sky.
Order right now. I know that we're reading this chapter from Feast, but in the reading order, this is three chapters from the end. Mm. So we've got Barry's last chapter right after this.
Yeah.
And then, I'm looking it up.
I think I looked at it last night. Do you end with Danny?
We end with Danny.
Yeah.
But I forget what's between.
John? Was there a John?
We got the epilogue.
The epilogue, then Barry.
Oh, Queen's epilogue, hands. Barry, you've done John.
Daenerys. Yeah.
So Vic's already outside of, he's going up Slaver's Bay. Mm-hmm. We've got the war's about to start, but of course we haven't got to that chapter yet. And Danny's flown away and she's been away for a little bit.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So this all kind of fits in.
Yeah. And the dragons are just kind of flying around.
So two dragons flying around, two
masterless
nukes flying around.
And nobody can control them.
Right.
Right. And she's still trying to figure out hers.
The one person who is supposedly supposed to control them is somebody who has blood that has a tendency to be like a reputation of being mad or things like that.
Tainted.
So.
So this all really proves the point of the faceless men, you know, the bravosi, the dragons are not,
They're too dangerous to allow. Yeah.
And something that can be used to dominate entire peoples and, oppress them. Mm-hmm.
Never mind that right now, right now Dany is, she hasn't really even used her dragons except for that one time at the beginning when they were quite little and she did use but that symbolizes how she could use them to dominate and oppress. And then it's a matter of perspective. I mean, so in her perspective, she's, you know, freeing slaves and doing good things. But from the perspective of the Yunkai, she's a terrorist.
Sure.
Right,
she came
right.
in and burned one of them. And, you know, she's not a force for good. And she basically destroyed their economy and, you know.
Disrupting the global...
Yeah.
Slave trade.
It is an irony that she is actually using the dragons as anti-slavery.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure that the faceless men would maybe not understand, but...
Maybe not be willing to put that much
that
faith
nuance,
in,
yeah, that nuance
in her,
to the
yeah.
dialogue. I think that they would probably be thinking, well, she might be a good dragon owner, but what about the next one? And what about the one after that?
Yeah,
all
sure.
it takes is one, you know,
bad
apple. Actor.
Well,
yeah,
and
exactly.
look, she's got three dragons. And as far as anyone knows, a person, a Targaryen or whoever, can control one dragon at a time. They bond with one dragon. There's, I mean, from the history that we know, there's never been anyone that had multiple dragons. So Dany's got three, and she's probably bonded with Drogon. You know, who's going to control those other two dragons? And that would be the point. And right now, you know, with the Hellhorn, we're poised to find out who finds that out.
Yeah.
So, or who's going to be controlling those two dragons? You know, that's.
She can change her mind too. Yeah. She can stop being good with the dragons.
Yeah.
She could.
That's
yeah.
The fear. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Easily.
Because she's human and it's, you know, she presumably has free will, although. Mm-hmm.
Determinism.
Yeah, that was our, talking about
our
that
previous
earlier.
Conversations we walked through the forest.
Maybe it's all predetermined, right. But we.
Really quickly. Before you change subject, I just want to, do you think that the Hellhorn is to control dragons? I'm looking at both of them, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it's supposedly for. So, you know, it's difficult. There's probably a twist, right? There's probably something that's being withheld by George. It could be something, the magic, Victarion might try and claim the horn, as it says. It's not who blows it, but who claims it. What, you know, what does that mean? What's the practical?
How does he do that? I know. Like, is like, he's they tells him, Makoro tells him to claim it with blood. So, like, does that mean that, like, you have to smear blood on it or make a blood sacrifice? Or does it mean something like, say, like the Elder Wand? Do you have to kill the previous owner?
Right.
That's a really common fantasy trope. And so, but if that's the case, and maybe Euron's the previous owner, well, they're two, you know, on opposite sides of the world right now. So I don't see how they change that effectively. So Euron is still the owner, I would think. But I don't know. I feel like Makoro knows a lot that he's not telling. So whatever is being withheld by George is in story is being withheld by Makoro. Mm-hmm. I think he knows what's going to happen with that thing.
Maybe we'll get a Makoro POV.
I would love that.
That would be pretty unbelievable. I would love
maybe
that.
Maybe he's the, wouldn't he be the epilogue? That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
That would be so cool. Well, and to see Victarion through Makoro's eyes, too, as he understands all these other things that we presume he may understand, and then how he views Victarion walking around, strutting
Mr.
around.
Victarion,
you know? I think that would be such a cool point of view on that character.
You'd see him as small and silly, probably.
Yeah.
I see you in my flames, Victarion. We don't want to become a discussion about Victarion because that could
very easily
be a very long sideways.
Well, what I was going to ask a little bit earlier, kind of going back to Daenerys and the dragons and Marwyn, I think something interesting about this chapter is we've spent so long hearing about Marwyn coming up in all these little different moments, and then we finally get to meet him, and then two pages later, he's sprints off.
Gone.
Yeah. And he's gone.
Right.
And so I guess my question for us to kind of talk a little bit about is what his motivations are and what his point, as we're talking about dragons and who thinks we should keep them and who thinks we shouldn't, and kind of their people's own personal goals with this huge power, what Marwyn and his role in that might be as he sprints off, seemingly after understanding more information that he didn't have before, or he got some sort of confirmation, whatever that was, not sure.
But if he has the glass cannon, what did he learn that he couldn't have deduced?
Understood before. I'm not sure. But whatever it was enough for him to immediately leave. So
was it Aemon's conviction that Dany?
It was Aemon's influence about the, believed
that he wouldn't have known that through the glass candle.
The Azor Ahai figure is Daenerys, and Marwyn is very skeptical of prophecy, but at the same time, I think, you know, he finds it alluring, and he's that type of character. From what we know about him in the books, he's taught Miri Mazdur how to speak the common tongue. He's talked with Qyburn about his weird necromancy fantasies or whatever it is. So he's someone that, you know, likes to indulge in the weirder kind of
thing.
He
has a very open mind about, you know, magic and darkness and alternative ways of viewing things. Yeah. Would this be a good time to talk about our Marwyn theory?
Oh, good
day. It's the perfect time, I would say.
Your boy's blushing.
So we've talked about this a bunch of times on Radio Westeros. That so George has said, let me kind of preface this by saying that George has said that we will one day know everything that there is to know about Robert's Rebellion. Mm-hmm. But there's a gigantic blind spot in Dragonstone, what was happening on Dragonstone, because everybody that was on Dragonstone is dead, except mm-hmm. for Dany, who was an infant. So how would we ever know what happened, you know, what was going down on Dragonstone if we're supposed to know everything about Robert's Rebellion? But then you think about sort of like the invisible people, servants, blah, 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 and maesters. So the Targaryens would have had to have a maester at Dragonstone. Somebody yeah. delivered baby Dany, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. And then you don't ever hear who that was. It's never mentioned. It's kind of, I feel like, purposefully cloaked, because by the time Stannis gets to Dragonstone and takes over, Cressen comes with him from Storm's End and right. becomes the maester at Dragonstone. So whoever was there previously, and usually the maester stays with the castle. We see that time and again. Somebody comes in, takes over. They, you know, Theon takes over Winterfell. Maester Lewin stays there. He's like, I serve the castle. So where did that guy go that delivered Dany, who mm-hmm. was the Dragonstone maester?
Yeah, and who was he? Who was
it? Who was he? And if he was the same person, I mean, it almost certainly would have been the maester who was serving Rhaegar, because actually that was Rhaegar's residence. So the idea that, you know, Rhaegar's maester was privy to all of his ideas about prophecy and everything like that, and then was there with Rhaella and delivered Dany, and then poof, disappeared. So you look around at who could fit that bill. And we wonder if Marwyn could be, because he did sort of leave Westeros and go to Ashai, right? Yeah. Traveled there. That's where he met Miri Mazdor at some point. And, you know, maybe that was about 15 years ago when yeah. that maester dropped out of sight. I don't know. It just would be a really interesting thing. It would be a really cool twist to add him in, because he would have so much knowledge of what Rhaegar was up to and the prophecies that he was...
And of Rhaella.
And of course of Rhaella. Yeah.
Someone that Dany barely thinks well, yeah. about. So we want to know, you know, which character connects...
For Dany, yes.
Provide
so if he's going to be with Dany, he could tell her about her mother. He could tell her about her brother. He could tell her lots of stuff about her family heritage and maybe about prophecies.
It would explain his bitterness.
Might
about
be.
Prophecy.
Yeah, he yes. so seems bitter. To be yeah. someone that's experienced the wrong end of a prophecy
the
going wrong
for yes. a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah.
And to see things just continue to happen, even yeah. though a prophecy says it's going to be a certain way, and to mm-hmm. still believe.
Right.
And he's probably hates himself for still believing, mm-hmm. but he's probably seen enough to know that it's worth believing in.
Yeah.
If you've been to Ashai, you know.
Yeah.
If you've been there, you have to believe in something weird.
And yeah.
It is weird incarnate.
Maybe the whole story about Dany finally, like, it could have been one of those moments when everything sort of fell into place for him. Like, all of a sudden he was like, oh, like, you know how Dany in the House of the Undying, she had that vision of Rhaegar and it kind of seemed like he saw her.
Yeah.
There's this weird, like,
which
moment.
Part?
So she goes in and she sees Ilya's in bed with the baby uh-huh. and Rhaegar's playing his harp. And then he looks at the doorway where she's standing and he says, oh, the dragon has three heads. There must be one more. But it's like he really actually, their eyes connect. It's a weird thing. So if he's spoken about that to his maester, and if, you know, that maester is Marwyn, you know, at some point, Marwyn could have been like, oh, it all makes sense now. Hmm. You know, it was her all along, blah, blah, blah. And that could explain his rush off to, you know.
He does sort of drop everything.
He does.
He really does.
It's almost like he's such a character filled with so much mystique that George built it up over a few books. Oh, there's a mystical character called Marwyn. And then we meet him and it's like peak excitement. And then he gets ripped away. Like, no, you can only have 2 pages.
You actually can't really learn that much about this guy. He's got to leave now.
He knows too much info and he's too much of an insider.
So he can't just be a random maester, right?
Totally.
He's
got
to be someone who has knowledge of stuff. And maybe it's really pertinent stuff like that.
What's he going to do when he meets Danny? What's the literary purpose of putting these two characters together? So the theory doesn't have much evidence, but it makes sense in that way where he could provide a lot of cool information if that was true.
I love that.
Totally.
No, yeah.
Well, I was thinking about something similar but totally different, but along the same kind of line of he has this glass candle that we know allows him to see things. And so I was thinking more of, instead of him actually being there, maybe he had access to some sort of visions that helped him kind of understand what was happening there, which then he can fill Danny in. But I like this idea of, like we've been saying, exposition and kind of filling in the backstory coming from somewhere other than Bran seeing it a million miles away and us relaying the info to the reader. Mm-hmm. Instead, we get another touch point to kind of look back into the past. That's kind of how I was thinking, but this a similar outcome though with him sharing this information finally.
This has that personal connection though that would explain like that a lot of his bitterness and his willingness to rush
and
out of the door.
And his headlong rush off to slavery's
totally.
Because that was pretty weird.
So you don't think that it could potentially be a little misleading? Because there's potential for, when I read this, I can see both sides of what he's saying. As he describes the gray sheep as being the bad guy, he could be the bad guy.
Yeah.
He could be the bad guy and they could be trying to do the normal thing. And he could have his own agenda. He could be aware of the power that's possible because he's in this place, if he's willing to be someone like Euron, because he's using the same technology and he's been to the same places. It's possible that he could be trying to seize power in some way on his own. And maybe this rush out of the door when he hears information that we think that he might have mostly known, of course, apart from the Aemon, the personal stuff with Aemon, then maybe this is a good way to sort of make Sam continue to do what he wants him to do at the Citadel and to get out of his way and allow Pate and allow Alaris Sorella to do it.
Could 100% be a twist.
But you think it's less likely?
I think it's less likely. I just feel like, he's significant enough. I mean, look, he's first mentioned in Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So obviously, George put a lot of setup into this character. He's in Game of Thrones, he's in A Storm of Swords, he's mentioned in the prologue of Feast, and then there you finally meet him right at the end of Feast. That's a lot of setup for someone to just be a minor random character or
to spend two pages with.
So his dash off page all of a sudden is like, all right, this guy means something, number one. And he means something that's enough that we got to keep him still kind of cloaked. But I want you guys to be thinking about him and what he's doing and where he's going to pop up next.
Even up to the description of his face, it seems to me that George really wants him to stand out for us to remember. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's, 2,000 characters, but this guy, don't forget about him,
He's very himself while he's doing
like
all these things. He's so himself.
He's a very proactive character, and he could probably steal a scene and, change someone's arc very quickly because he's so proactive. He's got this gravitas about him that he can, change someone's story, a bit like Makaro or someone like that. So I think he's going to be an important guy.
I'm going to read the mentions of him because we keep glossing over it. So I'm just going to read it for everyone at home that doesn't have a encyclopedic memory of all of his
appearances. Will you mention that he keeps company of whores and hedge wizards? He's surrounded by.
Good. I mean, that just further continues the rock and roll narrative.
I just wanted to put that in there before we talk about all the stuff he did. There you go.
Marwyn's travel lands beyond the narrow sea. Can't remember his journey and his travels. Marwyn spent 8 years in the east, mapping distant lands. Okay, so in Game of Thrones, Miri Mazder mentions to Daenerys Targaryen that she was taught about human anatomy by a maester named Marwyn, and probably much more. Storm of Swords, conversation with Jaime Lannister. Qyburn explains how he came to believe in the possibility of ghosts and mentions that all of the Archmaesters only, of all the Archmaesters, only Marwyn gives any matter, gives the matter any thought. Okay.
Hmm.
I'm trying to read sideways. Leo Tyrell tells the group of novices, tells the group of novices and acolytes assembled at the Quill and Tankard. Leo Tyrell tells the group of novices and acolytes assembled at the Quill and Tankard that Marwyn believes the tales of dragons are true and that he has managed to light an obsidian candle. Leo refers to Marwyn as the Mastiff and says that the Menagerie, other Archmaesters, hate him. I'm having trouble with that Archmaester. People want to call him Marchmaester. Asha Greyjoy finds Lord Roderick Harlaw reading Marwyn's book, The Book of Lost Books, in the Book Tower. George! The Book of Lost Books in the Book Tower.
The reader.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The reader, yeah. Okay, so I get it. It's the same thing with the candle. Where's the... How does fire get its power? Okay. Where does the dragon get its flame? Okay. Okay. It's like a vortex. Okay. Or a snake eating. It's me plugging this mic cable into itself.
Ouroboros.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
At Marwyn's request, Alaris brings Samwell Tarly to meet with Marwyn after talking to him at the Seneschal's court. Marwyn listens to Samwell's story and then declares that he is off to meet Daenerys Targaryen. He orders Samwell to keep quiet about Daenerys. We just read this. What am I? Mm-hmm. What? Sorry, I was focused on not making a reading error that I totally blocked out what the actual fact was. Anyway, those are the mentions of Marwyn.
That's
so
everything
far.
Seemingly yeah. Shrouded in strange situations, as we were kind of talking about earlier. Yeah. Like mm-hmm. He tends to show up
small
in weird
but
combos.
Really important mentions, though. Really important ones. And they're deep. He sounds really cool. And here we get to mm-hmm. meet him swaggering, chewing on sour leaf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if he taught Miri Mazder about anatomy, and then he was talking to Qyburn, and what is Qyburn? You know, Frankenstein.
Miri,
you know?
And Qyburn? What's left? Melisandre and Mikoro? That's it? Quaithe?
Right.
What?
I'm sure he knows Quaithe.
If he knows Quaithe, sure. Then what the hell is going on here? That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
Well, they've both been to a shy.
They've both been to a shy. If you think, Melisandre.
Yeah, so. Melisandre.
They're all pals.
It's a small world, isn't it?
Well, they all have access to some sort of visionary thing, you know?
It's like how people have their pilot's license, like hang out at like these weird airports off the grid. It's like little gas stations for planes that none of us have access to.
Yeah.
Right. They're doing that with glass candles in the nether sphere.
Right.
On the Weirwood Net.
Like, under the roots. Oh, hey, Mel. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Nice to see you here. Oh, yeah. How's it going? Oh,
what kind of stuff you've been seeing lately?
Yeah, like... what are you seeing up there? Oh, only snow? Yeah.
Lots of snow. That's all I see. Okay, that's cool. Okay, that's neat.
I'm looking forward to, as with everybody, ascending in the same place, looking for Daenerys.
Mm-hmm.
At what point he'll arrive, kind of in, because the battle's about to break there. Everything's about, all hell's about to break loose there. So,
we saw how dangerous the waters outside, the Red Wine Straits, how dangerous it is going to be for him to get out there, but I'm assuming he finds a way through.
Totally.
Like I feel like what we said, he's an important guy. I don't think he's just gonna
die.
No, not like that.
I was worried about that.
Yeah.
I was worried that what we might be talking about, all this momentum in our conversation might be foiled by Euron.
Right.
And Marwyn might become a tool for him to come right back into Old Town.
You know how Euron loves his wizards and
who's
priests
more powerful than this guy?
Right.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be much like George to just twist our guts like that, to give us this guy to look forward to give us this sort of epic and heroic introduction with Sam, to march out of the door because he's going to go make something happen? I'm going to go right to Daenerys and I'm going to tell her everything. Guess what? I helped deliver her the whole thing. And then Euron catches
him. You know, to feed on that, when Sam is thinking about what to do with Gilly, he thinks about sending her back on the Cinnamon Wind and thought, they'll keep her safe and maybe getting out of Westeros is the best thing for her because there's going to be a war here. But he thinks about how, when they came through on the inbound journey, the Ironborn left them alone because they're afraid, they wanted tamer prey. They didn't, they, really didn't want to tangle with the Summer Islanders. Mm-hmm. And side note, in a minute, I want to talk about Sam and his arrow, but, but I think, but then he's thinking basically what Sam settles on is that it's tempting fate. You know, he has this really in-depth kind of debate with himself where he's like, yeah, we made it past the Ironborn that one time, but what happens if you're, if they're going back and maybe now the Ironborn, there's more of them, or maybe, you know, maybe the winds die and they're becalmed and they're like sitting ducks. And I just, I read that and I was like, oh God, I hope that's not like some kind of George foreshadowing of yeah. what actually does happen. And the next time we actually see Marwyn is, you know, he's tied to Euron's masthead or something, right. You know?
Well, there's ideas too, though, potentially that Euron has access to a glass candle already, but maybe as he's like, has all these other like Valyrian tokens, like that might be something in his, arsenal already. And so maybe he already has some sort of connection with Marwyn because they're able to communicate or something in that way, potentially already they're tying them together.
Gas station in the sky.
Yeah, exactly.
Talking already, to each other. So. Pilot's lounge.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But
so if that's happening weird. And they're not on the same team, him doubling up his abilities, basically having a guy on his side that, it seems like Marwyn's able to do what he wants to do in Old Town. If his story is right and he's really against the Grey Sheep, but he's still an Archmaester, then how come this is happening in this way? You bring him back into town. He's got the run of the place. He's the one that's basically responsible enough and knows enough of the lay of the land to have a faceless assassin in his chamber, to have Leo Tyrell in his chamber, which can't say much for Leo, but he's there. And to have a lit glass candle just openly going, surrounded by books, this is like the hippie establishment of the, of the future truthers.
Yeah.
And I assume that they're not going into people's dreams and making bad stuff happen. So, like I said, if the story's right and they're just learning and trying to explore and figure stuff out, this is like the ground floor of that movement. I feel like having someone, if you're trying to take over Old Town, if you're trying to get in on Leighton Hightower's plan, having this guy on your side is going to make it even better. Will he need him? I don't know. If he, is he using the same technology as him? It seems like he is. But I feel like it's going to make it easier if they capture him and go back into Old Town.
Yeah. I mean, what if they're not? What if Euron doesn't have a glass candle, but it's capturing Marwyn that puts one in his hands? Or maybe he's maybe he's aware of the existence of this glass candle, and that's actually his goal.
What does that do for the rest of the story and the rest of everyone's, I guess, theories about how much Euron has been playing with people with the glass candle? If it, if Euron doesn't have one, he knows about one, wants to find one, wants to talk to people who have them and to squeeze out all their plans and memories and all the stuff that they know. Who else would have been manipulating dreams and or why, or I guess the stuff with Bran, especially in Game of Thrones, was it dream manipulation or are we just being suspicious based off of this chapter? What do you think, Matt?
Are you talking about Bran's coma dream?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems to be
a direct, someone's toying with them, right, in some way?
Yeah, that's Blood Raven's... Yeah, communicating to him and trying to get him to head towards his fate and train with him. He's like, he wants Bran to be his protege and he wants to be the mentor. So he's kind of calling him from afar.
So we've made that for sure. Everyone knows because of the direction that he's headed and because of the style of the communication and the way that he chose to talk to him. We all agree that that's Bloodraven.
Yeah, I think so.
So are there any other theories that come to mind? I was more so referencing the style of what's happening to Bran, where Euron has been doing the same thing to other people, maybe.
No, but I will mention that in Daenerys' final chapter, which you're going to come to in your reread soon, she sees Quaithe's face, and she says, I can't remember what she says, but she gives her some advice. And it says her mask was made of starlight. So she's basically having a waking dream and seeing Quaithe talking to her from the stars. So So that sounds very much to me like the description of the glass candle that in this chapter where Marwyn says, you know, you can insert yourself into someone's consciousness or dreams or however he describes it.
And the light is changing.
Yeah.
And starlight would be so like chromatic in that it basically represents the entire spectrum of color.
Yeah. And she's sort of, you know, tripping a bit.
Yeah, definitely. That's how I would describe it. It's usually how I describe it.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that she's just sick and that she's, but in the context of learning about the glass candle, it sounds very much like Quaithe is there doing that to her.
So Quaithe has access to one. Do you think she's in Karth or something, or she has her own?
I don't know. I mean, she's got to have one because she keeps showing up in Danny's point of view and not actually being there. I mean, like, what, 3 times, 4 times? Once on the ship and at least once, maybe twice in Marine. She comes to the garden once or twice in Marine.
She's not ever there.
She just comes, she talks.
Start because Jura sees her when they first.
Oh yeah, when they first meet
first out of Karth.
In the city,
but,
in
yeah.
the Peach City, and yeah. then whatever that's called.
In Marine, it definitely says that the guards didn't see her come in.
And on the ship, she was definitely not there.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, how would she be?
But then my question with all of that kind of stuff then is, so obviously. What? You know, so Quaithe is showing up in Daenerys' dreams, and we've got Marwyn seemingly bopping around and potentially, you know, doing the same thing.
I think we know the style in which it's happening to some degree.
Yeah, but so what's the point?
We can identify from the past and the story where this has happened. Or in this case with Dany, we can safely say maybe she's not just simply tripping, but she's being manipulated in some way by someone.
Yeah.
And so we can kind of reverse engineer to some degree who's doing this and why they're doing it. And it seems like they share common themes. A lot of it has to do with the Shy, et cetera. So it's like, who has this power? Why are they all doing it? And who's aware of it? Who's seeking it? As we're discussing, Euron might be. See, for me, I feel like I've read theories and I've had just sort of thoughts that never really coalesced. Like, okay, Euron's doing this too. But now the more we talk, it seems like maybe he's not.
Yeah, maybe he's not. I think it's easy with Euron to sort of
put more on him.
Yeah, everything I've read about Euron in theory-wise has always been, you know, quite far-fetched when you look at it.
Yeah.
But when you look at the actual evidence, he's just one of these characters where, you know, George is really encouraging us to, you know, let our imaginations run riot, but probably only a fraction of it is actually accurate.
Really. I think he's just a player. I think he's really good at manipulating situations to his advantage, and he lies constantly, but he's really smart about using, you know, whatever advantage he can.
He's got really strong instincts.
He does.
It's probably how he was able to survive in a place like Valyria. But I've always thought that he probably sacrificed other people's bodies ahead of him to make that be a reality.
Yeah. He would have no qualms about that.
This is my only like pessimistic view of this whole thing, but we've got, you know, these other magics happening at a seemingly high level. We've got all this manipulation happening at a seemingly high level. And I don't want it to be one of those quick and easy fixes that near the end of the story, it's like, oh, well, Marwyn was doing this the whole time and, he's the guy. And so that's it kind of thing. You know what I mean? Kind of the same for
like
Blood Raven.
Like,
this magic is coming into play seemingly near the end of the story. And so how does this actually tie everything up with the pretty bow without it just feeling like I said, like a cheap trick?
What if glass candles, like going forward, when the others are coming and, you know, humanity has to band together, what if glass candles become like a telephone?
Yeah.
You know, like a video chat, so people can communicate and band together and organize from, and that takes the distance factor
out
of it, and it just would allow George to do more things without being sort of, oh no, these people are too far apart, they couldn't meet up.
So here's a question though, because, and I actually think we touched on this a little while ago, but if you got Quaithe communicating with Dany via a glass candle and Marwyn wants to be with Dany when he has a glass candle, like, why does he leave? Why doesn't he just stay there and like get in touch with Danny and be like, hey, whatever, I need to tell you. Like,
I think he wants to be her maester. Foremost, he wants to. That is what Aemon was saying.
Because he was the maester that brought her into the world.
Danny needs a maester.
Yeah.
She's going to be this great savior, but she needs a maester.
Yeah.
And Marwyn is thinking, I better be the guy.
Yeah. No, it isn't.
I've been waiting for this.
Talk about assembling the team, because it's one thing that she doesn't have. She's kind of like been assembling all the trappings of power, of Westerosi power. You know, now she's got Barristan as her Kingsguard and stuff, or Queensguard. But the one thing she doesn't have right now is a maester to instruct her on all of the things that, you know, all the things maesters do. And they're probably, you know, they're the chief advisor pretty much for the kings of Westeros.
Yeah, so there's so many issues that they could help. I mean, she will at some stage have Tyrion for dragon lore, but there's
much
that
Tyrion
doesn't know that a maester would know. So.
Right. So you got your Hand of the Queen, which would be Tyrion.
Yeah.
You got your Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard, Barristan, and, well, you know, she needs a maester.
What about Jorah?
I don't know.
Jorah's just an admirer.
He'll just sulk.
Gotta have plenty of those.
Well, we've actually, that's a hell other different story. But imagine when Victarion, Jorah, and Dario are in the same room. Because that's about to happen.
Yeah. The Spider-Man's pointing at each other meme.
Exactly. Like, one of them has to, they've got to, like, I don't know. Someone's going to not survive that. Or it's going to go very badly. So I don't know.
So that's interesting. So he's basically saying there's some kind of a pantheon in some way. And it's for George, I mean. And then so Marwyn to some degree sees value in it enough to add himself to that build of the actual court to create the spearhead that makes a difference in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. I
mean, so do you think he just overlooked? Like, the thing you brought up, I thought, is that's really important that he had that glass candle sitting there in the room surrounded by books and papers.
Yeah.
Glowing, ready, already on.
He could have just been like, hey, Danny, I'm on my way.
To some degree,
degree. Like, something. Like, send her a message, let her know. I mean, it could be cryptic or it could not be cryptic. Like, I don't know if you have to talk like in circles like Quaithe does.
Maybe he's already doing that. We just don't know about it.
The stuff with Quaithe is it makes it seem like she's trying to give Danny as much of a choice as possible while telling her exactly what to do. And I guess in some way, and that'll be important in some way. Maybe it helps retain order. Or maybe they know in Ashai, and maybe they know in the House of Black and White that too much influence creates a disharmony, and it starts to you can't really make a long term plan and manipulate lots of different nodes if you're manipulating one specifically too much. So they try to keep a balance by being, which is probably the reason they would rather like silently take out the dragons. Then go kill whoever has the dragons.
Yeah.
Let's just silently get rid of this superpower, and then we can help retain balance. I forget what the mantra is for it's not only death can pay for life. It's the House of Black and White's mantra, is it? That's a red faith thing, right?
That's something that Miri says.
Okay, yeah. So it's just a sort of idea.
Yeah, but she may have got that from Ashai. It's just a magical, sacrificial saying of some sort.
In a kind of, I mean, you have to work to make something cool. And so that work is that death. So you can apply that metaphor in many other situations. So I'm just curious about the balance that they seek and whether or not they're going after the dragons for that reason to sort of take that possibility out of there. But I don't know. It seems like all these things are connected in some strange way. And if you're not being forthcoming with Danny, when you have the technology to appear in the sky like Mufasa, surrounded by stars, and to go, I'm telling you something very straight up. But as you said, Matt, she did really just come kind of straight up with her recommendations. She was just like, well, this is what I think you should do. So I don't know.
Is that when she said you must go east to go west? You must go east?
I don't recall. I haven't read that chapter for a while. But
you guys are going to read it and you'll tell us.
We'll give you the breakdown in a couple weeks.
I think that was in a previous chapter, but I could be wrong.
I do too. Yeah.
How am I supposed
to
remember?
That's her advice.
This is a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff, and she now is appearing for a whole new technology. See, to me, have you guys ever played The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time?
Yes.
You know Sheik?
Which one's that one?
The spoiler alert, everyone. Turn off the podcast if you've never played Zelda and you care that much. Sheik, you know who later turns out to be Zelda?
Oh, okay.
With the Deku Nut. She throws the Deku Nut and disappears.
Right. Oh, okay.
Sheik is like, I thought that in my mind, Quaithe is always just Sheik.
Yeah.
has the acrobaticness and intelligence of the land. Yeah. Right. So years later in this story, Link is put in a time capsule from when he's a kid and he comes out as an adult. And there's this really smart, kind of like how the Sphinx is in this chapter to Sam, character that's like, I'm going to show you around. Things are crazy. The whole world's changed.
You need a guide.
Exactly.
Yes. Yep.
Really capable. So I just assume that Quaithe is really athletic. Got up to the top of the pyramid, but it's totally different now.
Yeah.
So physically appearing in non-physical form, in a very physical seeming way, that's pretty powerful. And I wonder whether or not if you have more strength in the use of the glass candle, you can make more sense of it and make more sense to the people that you're trying to channel. I wonder what it's like to be able to see through space and time, if you can, if it has the same sort of vein of connection that the Werewood Network has.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. As I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about, you know, does it go in every direction? And it would kind of have to. Like, you see the past and you can see the future.
Probably depending on your ability.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like the Werewood, I mean, it's just another technology like that. And like that, you know, that TV show Devs that we were talking about before, that was the problem with that technology. It started as a way to maybe peer into the past, but then they realized that it's a circle. Yeah. Time is a flat circle.
No.
And they more think HBO about like stuff. Oh, you think about like Melisandre, what she could do with something like a glass candle, just because she has so much experience. I know that staring into the flames is a little bit of a different technology, but
it's like the old version.
Well, right. Like if her technology was a little bit more powerful, she might have more. I mean, she seemingly has a decent track record, but could up her game a little.
For sure.
She's good. She sees the right things in the flame, but she's always wrong. But that's not, it's not that she saw the wrong thing. She saw
interpreting
the thing.
It wrong.
She's just like, yeah, that guy in green, that's definitely Renly. Nope, wasn't Renly. Sorry. That girl in gray, definitely Arya. Nope, sorry, not Arya. Oh,
if she had like a clearer picture with this glass candle, she might better be able to interpret.
It's like a cassette versus a CD.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
She always picks the coolest option too. It didn't have to be Arya. She's like, oh, but it's totally Arya.
Right.
The Arya. Yeah. It doesn't have to be the coolest option. It could just be another thing. That's very interesting.
I think it's really interesting that's how the book ends. Like Feast for Crows isn't full of magic and wonder and mystique, is it?
Mm.
It's very, you know, the aftermath of war. Mm-hmm. The themes are, you know, more traditional. Mm. And, you know, it's written in a different kind of style from some of the other books. And that's how we end it. George is sort of wafting this bit of magic towards us and saying, you know, this is what's coming up. It's going to be a lot more mystical in the future, and just gives us a little taste to get us excited. I kind of like that. And the bookend with the prologue and the final chapter being both in the same place.
Mm-hmm. It's just so exciting for Sam to find. I know we already talked about this, but just to add another point to that is just how exciting it is to have Sam at the center. He's going to learn so much, you know? He's going to soak it all up as quickly as he can. And I love that guy. And now he gets to be in this cool place. I'm so happy for him.
I'm going to read this breakdown. This is what Sam has gone through to get us to this point. This is what he told. Sam chewed on the question for a moment, wondering how much he ought to say. The Sphinx is the riddle, not the Riddler. Could Maester Aemon have meant this Sphinx? It seemed unlikely. Lord Commander Snow sent him away to save his life, he began hesitantly. He spoke awkwardly of King Stannis and Melisandre of Ashai, intending to stop at that. But one thing led to another, and he found himself speaking of Mance Rayder and his wildlings, king's blood and dragons, and before he knew what was happening, all the rest came spilling out. The Whites at the Fist of the First Men, the other on his dead horse, the murder of the Lord Commander, the Blackbird. Sorry, I skipped. The murder of the Old Bear, the murder of the Old Bear at Craster's Keep. Gilly in their flight, White Tree and Small Paul, Cold Hands and the Ravens, John becoming Lord Commander, the Blackbird, Darren, Braavos, The dragon Zondo saw in Karth, the cinnamon wind, and all that Maester Aemon whispered toward the end. He held back only the secrets that he was sworn to keep about Bran Stark and his companions and the babes Jon Snow had swapped. Daenerys is the only hope, he concluded. Aemon said that Citadel must send her a Maester at once to bring her home to Westeros before it's too late. And now he's from the wall to Old Town in a waiting room.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Just sitting in a waiting room.
Yeah.
Waiting for the dentist to
say about his arrow earlier.
Oh. Well, this was just kind of like part of the Sam improvement arc, you know. As they're coming in, they're coming through the Red Wine Straits on the approach, and they get, you know, an Ironborn longship starts to tail them, and the archers, the Summer Islanders, stand up with their big giant bows, and they draw. They wait until the longship is within 200 yards, and they loose, and the arrows all fall into the incident, and they turn around and leave because they're like, too much. No, don't want to deal
with
this.
Tame or prey.
So Sam thinks that his arrow made it. And do you remember when he was back at the wall, John used to force him to do archery practice, mm-hmm. and he could never shoot the damn arrow. He was always like, you know, crying about his finger. It makes my fingers hurt. Can I just go read in the cellars? Like, he was awful. Like, I don't even think he could hit the target. He was horrible at it. Like, and now all of a sudden in the Sam improvement arc, mm-hmm. he shot a giant golden heart bow, an arrow 200 yards. That's amazing. That's 600 feet. That's so far. And it made it.
Yeah.
Like it hit the target.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, that's big. That's a big change for him.
I was thinking that whenever he was, I forget the name of the castle at the edge of the Whispering Sound that he and Gilly were looking at the beginning.
It's costing 10 towers maybe or something. It's towers. It's definitely
some towers. Definitely.
Remember
involved.
Him saying the seat of house. That's the seat of House Costain, and I have this kind of like really cool image because they describe it like with the lights in the windows,
corpses floating through the water. Just a callback to the whole book.
Floating through the water.
I got the impression that
three towers.
Okay,
not ten.
Three towers.
Three towers somewhere else.
Three really good ones.
They've only got three though.
I got the impression that his realization of the potential danger of Old Town being infiltrated by the Greyjoys and of Cersei and those in charge in King's Landing not doing enough to stop this from happening, potentially becoming the infection that spreads to the rest of Westeros, first at a place like Hornhill that's not too far away, and then everything else. I feel like he might be one of the only people thinking about it at this point. And I feel like him making that shot and him, I guess really we can just put it there, but the other examples y'all are using at the beginning of the conversation about his, I guess, the way that he's framing how he's thinking about taking care of Gilly, I'm afraid that it might be his responsibility, partially his responsibility to make sure that doesn't happen now.
Yeah, no, to see to the, he's not maybe just going to see to the defense of Gilly.
Right.
It might be a lot bigger than that.
Because he's thinking about it.
Yeah.
I don't know who else is thinking about it.
He's thinking about it.
Cersei's not. And she's in charge.
When he was having those thoughts about Gilly, honestly, I was reminded that he is Randall Tarly's son. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, you know, his father is really, you know, he's known as a great commander, you know, and, you know, he's humorless and horrible and did terrible things to his own son. Yes. But, you know, in terms of, you know, military, you know, experience, he's one of the best. And the other thing I was thinking about, and this is just maybe kind of an aside too, is that Randall Tarly is really tall. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we've ever been told that Sam is tall or isn't tall. And I was wondering, because all of a sudden I just had this mental image of Sam actually being really tall, like his father, maybe. And maybe that's why everybody still thinks of him as this kind of giant, like, you know, a black clad whale is what Leo calls him.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, he lost a lot of weight.
He
had to have. He talks about it. He mentions it a couple of times. Maybe he is just really like this 6.5 foot
like
tall
big guy.
Like,
maybe he'll transform.
They've never specifically said, and we all have a certain headcanon
exactly.
because of the show. So we picture him as this kind of short, you know, roly-poly guy. But maybe that's not how George pictures him. I don't know.
So he might physically change whenever he's... I mean, that would give into the harmony that George often paints into scenarios and his characters in a story. If it physically came into being the same time his brain sort of got there.
Yeah, and if he actually... It would be really ironic if he grows to be more like his father, like a good version of Randall Tarley.
Right.
You know?
Like, isn't that what all of the characters are kind of leading in that direction?
And considering what his father did to get rid of him, because you're not my son, I don't want a son like you. If he comes back and he's like this, I don't know, if he turns out to be like the savior of the Reach.
Right.
You know? Imagine what his father would think. Be like, whoa.
It's like some Tyrion kind of
energy
with his own father.
Yeah. It just seemed like it wouldn't be mentioned. It just didn't seem George's style, just going from book one to book four to book one to book five, book two to book five. These things that are little windows normally have something comes back to it.
Yeah.
And he thought about it so clearly. I'm thinking, well, you know, you might just have to do that now. You might have to, that annoying thing of like, how are they going to do that? Might be something you're like, oh, I have to take care of now.
Damn it. Now I have to do it. You touched it last. It's
exactly.
Yours,
right? Yeah. And it sounds like a fun idea when you're not involved at all. But when you're at the point where Sam would be at, which is not far from now, to like for it, he's probably going to be in Old Town. Shit's going to be going down. Some people are dead. Maybe they're not. He knows a lot more because he's been around the situation, literally traversed around the continent enough. They're probably going to be like, what do you think?
Yeah.
What should we do here?
And he's been through all that laundry list of stuff that he tells Alaris, you know, all those things preparing him for something, you know, for some...
Who's going to be better suited?
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, I came here to read all these books and for everyone to leave me alone.
Exactly.
To learn, and then he's thrust into.
That's,
could be interesting. Yeah.
That's not what you're going
to
do.
So he's becoming an unlikely hero. Mm-hmm. Like, you're starting to see this guy has got the makeup of a hero, you know, but
he's
an unlikely one. He started off as this kind of craven coward that everyone picked on, and he's not going to end the book like that. He's got a great arc.
Unless he dies the way that we saw him transform with his mindset around Gilly that we were talking about at first, it's not because he's gone through like a quest line and now he's been experience points and leveled up. The reason why he's standing on the side of the ship and thinking these things is because he's aware of these things.
Right.
That's the only reason he's thinking about it, because he's gone through enough life to have these concerns and to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's like real life. It's like he doesn't have – no one tells you can now make a good decision or a bad decision about these people that you're taking care of. If you're taking care of these people and you're not aware of like the scenarios, you're just going to – whatever's going to happen to you is going to happen to you. But if you're aware of what you can do, you're going to be thinking about it at some point.
Right.
You'll be standing alone at some point thinking to yourself, what should I do about this? Mm-hmm. And now you're that unlikely hero that we were talking about. Like, you're that person. And so if you're in the position to think about the realm in some objective way and you're comparing it to all these other options, who else are they going to ask? Who else is going to have the right answer? And that's kind of the same situation that got John to be picked for Lord Commander, because it's like, out of all of us, who's been doing all of these things and who can actually command the respect of these many people at one time?
Yeah.
Well, we just lost one, so we're picking a new one. It's probably this guy.
And who orchestrated that?
Sam.
Who understood it? Who was there,
exactly.
You know, watching John and probably learning right along with him, to be fair, and, you know, made that happen.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah. You just kind of like go in. It's not like someone tells you can now do this. It's just he's done enough to where it's just he's at that point now, it seems.
Sleeping with Gilly really.
Yeah, really did it
really
for him.
Really changed him.
Right? Yeah, right.
Became made him a real man.
That's what's happened.
It was literally a manhood arc. I mean, there's no...
George is like, how do I convey that this is a manhood story? Oh, I know.
Oh, actually make him a man.
Right.
Yeah.
Crazy.
He's sad. Like, they pull up to Old Town. He's like, oh, man, it's over. The journey's over. And he's like, feels a little sad. I was like, I know why you're sad, Sam.
I don't want to get off this boat. I'm so many other people's agendas. Think about all the other people he has to talk to, their plans, how
my
they want their lives
on this
to
boat
go.
Too, you know?
So much more simple. Just my girl and these people we've already met. I already know their whole deal.
Yep.
Don't have to do all that.
He wants to be back at the wall telling his friends what he's being.
Right,
that too.
Exactly.
That too. At least have enough time to go tell them like what he did and then to go off and do his own thing again.
Guys, you'll never believe it.
How much would he give to be in the basement or in the library rather of Castle Black with a candle and just figuring out things instead of having to do them? Doesn't that sound nice?
I don't know. He was, as we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, as he's wandering through the streets of Old Town, he's like, should have been doing this the whole time.
But I hope no one recognizes
me.
I don't know if it's worse that they... Is somebody that hates my father? Yeah. Someone that knows my
feeling.
Father?
Yeah. Like, so relatable. Like,
So
is, on the same topic, is this what Sam needs to prove himself as a man, a showdown with Randall? Mm. Is that where we're headed with this? You know, he's going to study at the Citadel, but as well, is he going to confront his father in some way and sort of prove himself as a man somehow? Is that where this like arc we're talking about is headed? What do you think?
Yeah. I like the idea of that. Yeah. Just because he's still so much in his head and so much of his self-doubt and like these other influences are, it's like when he's having that conversation with Leo, when he asks, this was going to be my own. And so I haven't pulled up, but he's like, I'm Sam, I'm Lord Randall Tarly's son. And he's like, are you still a craven? Weren't you, like, everyone thought you were dead. Is it because he wished that you were dead or because he wasn't? You know, so much about Sam's, where he is about his father. And so I like this idea that he somehow...
It would be like shedding a skin, you know, for him to grow further, get rid of this, you know, these thoughts and this control that his father still has on him after all this time.
Yeah. I like the idea that maybe he, well, you know, in terms of him, like, stepping up and taking responsibility, maybe he goes to Horn Hill and that thing he was thinking about, oh, I'll inspect the defenses there and make sure it's suitable for Gilly. He doesn't think about his mom or, you know, he's not like, I want to make sure my mom's safe. He's like, no, I want to make sure it's safe for Gilly. And if it's not, I'll take Gilly back to Old Town. Not my mom. I'll leave her there because whatever. But what if he does that? And in the process, he actually does something amazing and that results in saving Horn Hill or saving his mother, or saving, you know, saving everybody.
Right.
And Randall Tarly kind of rolls up at the end and he's like, wait,
you did this?
Samwell?
Yeah.
You did
he's not
you?
Gonna, that's not going to be enough.
You know?
It's like, got to be another book then after that.
I like that as an added piece to his whole
it would just be the greatest. Manhood journey. Sam could just be like, yep. All right, I'm done with. I feel like that would purge the whole Randall thing from him and just be like,
that would be cool.
Every nerd with overbearing parents is like, please let this happen.
Let that be the thing that happens. Yes.
I'm afraid that he's going to be at the, in the position to choose whether or not Randall lives or dies or something.
Mm. Oh, dark.
In a scenario.
Yeah.
He's like, that's the person that did all this stuff to me, but I'm on this side now that has more power in this scenario.
Yeah.
I think at that point he'd have to be inside of Danny's club, I guess, at that point. Mm. If she does end up coming and there's fights in the Reach like that, like we saw depicted in the show, then it could be a similar scenario. I don't know if it's going to turn out that way, but it'd be cool to see Sam involved in that. Do you guys think that Sam will be involved with Danny in any way if he's staying at Old Town?
I'm not really sure. I think, you know, there's so much, because now you have Aegon too. So I think a lot of the Reach lords are going to go over to Aegon. I mean, Sam actually thinks in this chapter, when they meet the sort of guard ship, the Huntress outside on the approach into Old Town, that guy, you know, is very bitter about Cersei.
Yeah.
And Sam is shocked. He thinks if King's Landing loses Old Town and the Arbor, the whole realm will fall to pieces. Well, I think that is exactly what's going to happen because you've got Aegon and there's a lot of, you know, theories that various friends in the Reach, whatever, you know, whoever they may be, I mean, it may not be specifically Old Town and the Arbor, although I think maybe it will be, that, you know, at least abandon Cersei. And then I don't know how that plays into Dany, you know,
she's not there. Yeah.
She's not there. So right now it's going to appear to be a contest between Aegon and Cersei.
Mm.
And I think that's the way the chips are going to fall, at least in the short term. So Sam will be, maybe, I don't know, on whatever side makes sense for him to be on. You know, let's say Euron and Cersei end up aligned, you know, he's probably not going to be on that side.
No.
So
I couldn't imagine that.
So I guess, I mean, it's almost like, am I saying Sam's going to, like, if he has to be on a side, is it going to be Aegon's side? I don't know. He's definitely, I don't know if I would go out on that limb.
I don't know how we're going to get no in one book. Because I feel like what we're talking about is post-Wins. Hello, appearance of a kitty.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like we need three.
Right.
At this
it's going to be, yeah. We may not get all these answers for any time soon.
Unless Fagan's campaign starts in King's Landing at the beginning of the next book. Mm. You know how it seems like it's going to build to that eventually being the goal? Mm-hmm. And so we've got A Dream of Spring to extend whatever truth that is. But maybe they perish at the end of Winds. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to go. But it seems like a couple more books, judging by how his normal pace and flow of the POV goes.
It's a lot to fit into two more books.
It is a lot. It is a lot. And very specifically, the style in which he arcs these points of view.
Right.
They don't normally go through multiple Titanic shifts. They go through one good Titanic shift each book.
Yeah.
And then that's it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I really don't know.
Mm-hmm. I think things have to be pretty simple, relatively, you know. I don't think things can get too convoluted because I just don't see where the page space is going to come from to explore, you know, multiple twists here and there. I think it's got to be more direct story.
Well, he's going to have to start killing people off, you know, pretty swiftly. POV characters,
converging them.
Yeah. Well, they are all, a lot of them are converging.
They are, yeah.
When they are together, then you can lose one here and there.
But if they're still alive, then you're left with the, like, you know, let's say you got Arianne and John Connington, and they're both still alive, but they're converging in the same place. If he just abandons one of them, you would be left with this always sort of like, wondering, I don't know. It just
or like Tyrion and Dany when they're in the same place.
All of that is,
gets the POV.
Do they both? You know, I mean, you've had obviously instances where two people in the same place had a POV, but not in a while,
or for such a long
or for such a long and important stretch. Yeah. So it's just going to be interesting the way it's all handled.
It just feels like it's at critical mass and. Mm. He needs to be really succinct to pull this off, and I'm sure he will do it.
I am too. I'm trying to use the math and figure out how it goes. It's like when you hear the soundtrack of something before it comes out, you're like, judging by the music, this is how it's going to go. This is what's going to happen in the story. It's like that same sort of thing. He's got all these other books, and it seems like he is really appreciative of the art form of making a book seem cool. And not just the way that he writes it, but the way that he sort of thematically follows a pattern throughout the publishing order.
Definitely. And pacing and all of that.
The way he's naming the chapters now. And so judging by that artistic flourish, it's like these next two books have got to be pretty massive.
Yeah.
Because he likes to burn it out in a way that makes sense, not just give you the answer. Mm-hmm. Just straight up. He likes to express the whole thing.
And so many reveals are like a little bit from here and a little bit from there. And then all the different sides are coming in and information coming from various places that it's must be getting harder to weave that tapestry as everybody gets closer together and you get closer to the end game.
What do you think the Citadel specifically is trying to build? And why wouldn't we be able to trust, why wouldn't they trust Marwyn and Aemon? Mm. Why is Aemon untrustworthy? Is it simply because of his blood?
Because of his blood?
Mm. And Marwyn's not a Targaryen. So
Not that we know of.
But I feel like it's a pretty 25% chance that he is one.
Well, according to Marwyn, they're trying to build a
world without
concrete
magic. Yeah.
World where, you know, there's nothing mystical or...
It's just science. It's maybe it's the fantasy equivalent of the Enlightenment, you know, the scientific revolution, you know, the Age of Enlightenment, where where in real life we gave up on sort of, I mean, they didn't give up on religion, but they became very much more, everything was much more scientific, you know, in that age, things were, you know, mysticism and superstition and things like that, that had driven human existence for millennia. Like, they really didn't change much. The human condition did not change very much until all of a sudden massive change with the advent of science and that sort of, you know, rational philosophy. So, you know, maybe this is the fantasy equivalent of that. You know, that's what the Citadel is trying to achieve. You know,
so they
really change things.
They're aware of the existence of power in some way, some mysterious power. And they know that because they've chosen not to use it, to try to squash it out, that it's possible to get rid of it in some way.
Yeah.
By erasing the memory of it and by erasing the physical manifestation of people that know how to manipulate it in some way.
Yep.
They probably watched the Targaryens rip each other to shreds.
Read the books.
And just thought, this isn't a world with a future. You know, this shouldn't. So I guess they've got something in common with the faceless men that we were discussing earlier.
Well, I definitely
earlier.
Think, yeah, that there's
common
a,
ground, at least.
There's definitely a Venn intersection of their goals.
So what's the likelihood that Marwyn knows that Pate is not Pate?
That's an interesting question, because I was thinking about that.
I think you would let him into his quarters.
I don't think so.
If he suspected that he was, a guy under...
Given, if Marwyn is, you know, if we can accept Marwyn at face value and, you know, he's a sort of antithesis of the gray sheep who are trying to create a world without magic. And if, also, as we just said, there's that intersection between the world without magic the Citadel wants and the world that the faceless men want, then Marwyn would not view Pate as an ally, Pate Jackin.
Right.
So yeah, I don't think he can. This is what I was thinking about earlier today. I don't think he can know who he is. Or he wouldn't have left him in charge of Sam. Yeah,
he's right there with the lit candle.
Yeah, the lit candle.
Good luck with that.
And Jackin is one of the best in the game.
He's so good. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, because Marwyn's one of the best in the game, and he's just sitting there cross-legged on his floor.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. I'm Pate like the pig boy, and that's when you read the prologue again, you realize that that's the last thing the real Pate would have said, because he hated being called the pig boy.
Absolutely.
But that's how you can be sure that he isn't Pate there, because he says something that Pate would never ever say in a million years.
Right.
It's used against him, that term. Mm.
I wonder if the people that know him will kind of.
Yeah,
you know, like,
Pate's calling himself the pig boy.
Yeah.
Is he
She's
good?
Smart, you know, he should be like, he doesn't like that. What happened with that?
Sirella, too.
Yeah.
So, some sharp people. And also participating in subterfuge at that same moment. So, very suspicious on lookout for that kind of stuff.
There's two.
Leo looks like he's spying.
Mm-hmm.
Pate's spying.
Yeah.
Sirella's probably spying.
Yeah. Oh,
and then
sure.
Sam like barrels in with all
Here comes
the info.
Sam. He's just like, let me tell you this story. This crazy story. And they're all like,
help
Whoa.
Myself.
Yeah.
It's so perfect. They're on the Isle of Ravens in Old Town, surrounded by corking birds, a rundown weirwood tree that still works, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Lots of ravens, the white ravens, which you all know what purpose they have. It's just what a cool collection of people in a cool spot.
And it is.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And how funny is it that Leo Tyrell was using that candle to try to see naked girls?
Yeah.
That's funny. You think he was telling the truth? I do.
For sure. That's too real.
Yeah, he's like...
So willy-nilly there. That's the vibe of his little hangout. I light the candle and these guys hang out and they look at it when they want, right? Because they don't know how to light it. That's the whole thing. They don't know anything about it. But I don't know.
Hey, Marwyn, can I... take a little gander.
How many
gander?
POV chapters will it be before Sam uses the candle? And he peers in like he's not supposed to
the
or something.
The next one. No one's in there.
It's
going to
be
like
the next chapter.
Yeah.
He comes back. He's going to be, it's like preying on his mind. Although he's going to do something with Gilly because he told her he'd come back the next day.
Yeah. He's going to be like Pippin.
But I do think he's going to be like, you know,
Just see what John's up
back
to.
There. Yeah.
He's like, I
what
John.
Is he going to do? And then, but, you know, like, it's just a weird sort of.
Because then he sees that John is gone.
Right. Yes. Like, are you looking straight ahead? Are you looking backwards, forwards? Like, does he know how to control it? Is there a way to control it? Or you just see what it shows
right.
you?
Right.
You
know? Remember Sauron and the Palantir?
Yeah.
In Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
On accident.
Yeah.
I was very suspicious of what Gandalf was hiding.
Yeah.
I want to take a look at it.
Yeah.
And then now this horrible fate precedes me and I set things in a chain of motion that I maybe shouldn't have. So
yeah.
That's possible. We know that George is a big fan of Tolkien. Maybe that mm-hmm. same sort of thing might happen.
Yeah. I definitely think that the glass candles, if we're going to go there, I think they're definitely a nod to the Palantir that's
for sure.
Exactly what those are. They're glass balls instead of candles.
They're
things that sorcerers use to communicate with each other in faraway places.
There's weird shit like that through folklore, like crystal balls, any kind of scrying, channeling tool. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense that we finally get to this point in the story. For us, it's at the end of the last two books because the way we ordered it, but it's at the end of the fourth book to where there's a physical manifestation of magic in some way. And it is linked to dragons. It is a piece of dragon glass. It's obsidian. Mm-hmm. We know at this point in the story, if we're reading it even in the published order, that it kills things like White Walkers and that it's really difficult to work with.
Yeah.
And there's a quote here where Sam asks how it gets lit. And so we get kind of an uncharacteristically flat answer while still mysterious, but kind of a flat answer to how it works. It burns but is not consumed. And a great question from Sam, what feeds the flame? What feeds a dragon's fire? Marwyn seated himself upon a stool. All Valyrian sorcery was rooted in blood or fire.
Yeah.
The sorcerers of the Freehold could see across mountains, seas, and deserts with one of these glass candles. They could enter a man's dreams, give him vision, speak to one another half a world apart. Seated before their candles. Don't you think that might be useful, Slayer? So, I mean, like I said, at this point in the story, there's a physical manifestation. George has told us all these different reasons why magic seems to exist. The fire ladder in Karth sticks out in my mind out of a bunch of them. The existence of the dragons after how the eggs were petrified and Danny came out living. Oh, the shadow baby. That's it. That's the only one I need to mention.
Right.
A person climbed out of another person that was a shadowy guy, went through bars, and then killed someone in real life. And no one was tripping, you know? No, I mean, it really happened. So we know there's magic. Here it is. And Sam asks the all-important question, how does this work? Because that's what the maesters hear, the archmaesters, the gray sheep, seem to be wanting to stamp out. If we're right, if our conversation is right, if what we're saying is right. So the right question to those who are curious, not just who have an idea of like bias against believing in it or really wanting to use it. What feeds the flame? Because I want to know how it works. And Marwyn's question is a lot like this. What would you call it? Was it again the snake eating its own tail?
Yeah, Ouroboros.
It's like that. What feeds a dragon's flame? But I feel like there's more of an answer in there than I've thought of before. Because what feeds a dragon's flame is the dragon being alive, right?
Yeah, blood.
So the blood.
Really, the blood, yeah.
And so what
Fire
is the blood?
And blood.
It's like the collection of choices of the beings over the course of history on a particular planet, I guess. So it's like the lineage equals the possibility for the people that are currently alive later in life to be able to do the thing. So it seems like maybe the answer to how this technology exists on the Earth is just that it's like snowballed over time and became this in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And what's powering is it itself, the existence of reality in the first place, the existence of this planet in the first place. And I guess the way that George wanted to coalesce it with the typical sort of ore from mythology would be obsidian, dragon glass,
right.
You know, the heating, superheating of fire, stuff that is derived from dragon, like dragon bone stuff. Shoot, like a dragon bone bow probably shoots further than Golden Heart, even though Golden Heart's pretty cool. It's like, well, for some reason, this dragon rib pulled in a certain way, or we use his heartstring in a wand, and it might be certainly powerful versus these other things. So a dragon-like thing is usually harder to get because I guess dragons are rarer, they're harder to tame, that kind of thing. So there's probably other windows to magic that George might not have to get into, but there's also different kinds of bows to use. Mm. I feel like what he does is he's really appreciative of all these hierarchical equipments and different sorts of ideas within stories. And instead of going into it, we get little vignettes of it, like the with the Golden Heart bow on the ship.
Yeah.
I get to appreciate it. It made me feel cool because it reminded me of stuff that I like, of like equipment lists and games and getting better ones over time.
Yeah.
And so it shoots further than the other ones, and it even helps Sam shoot a little bit better, maybe, because it was further.
Yeah.
So it was like a combination of him doing well and leveling up. But he's got a better bow.
Magic, yeah.
He's got better bows.
Level 10 bow now instead of that one you get at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Right. But in most fantasy books, they're like you follow Harry or you're split between a male and a female.
Mm.
And there's more time to fill in the book. There's more pages that you physically have to fill. So there's more time to go into the rabbit holes about the kinds of equipment and the kinds of the order of things and how they make sense on the planet and the different kinds of magic. So I think that there's probably more to what this planet is able to reproduce through its people and through the different technologies outside of just dragonglass. But I think maybe this is one that survived, or it's the most preeminent of the time. I mean, the effect that we have right now to back that up is because the trees, the technology of the Blood Raven, I don't think he's using a glass candle in that tree. I think he is using the Weirwood Network, right?
Yeah, sure.
But it's the same sort of thing.
Yeah,
it's channeling into the Oblivion.
Ice and fire equivalents of each other, the different magic systems.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, most of the magic that we see working, so setting aside, you know, there's Blood Raven and probably the others seem to be maybe ice magic. I don't know if Weirwood's, if you would, you know, categorize that as that, but the rest of the magic is, it's all fire or blood, you know, whether it's dragons or whether it's, you know, seeing things in flames or sacrifice, blood sacrifice, or creating a shadow baby, which has got some sort of fire or blood magic because of who does it. I mean, that's her, that's her type of magic. I'm sorry.
Each one of us has that. Everyone has every done single that. Zach.
It's going to happen to me.
I'm going to call you five times right now.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, he's creating a, you know, a sort of a dichotomy, I guess, of two different types of magic.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be anything else besides those two things.
We need to go to a shy.
We need to, obviously.
Like Marwyn.
Right.
Or go to Sothorios. How do you guys pronounce it? Sothorios?
I say Sothorios. Sothorios. Yeah.
It's spelled two different ways.
Sothoros. Is it really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I think it's Sothoros and Sothorios.
Sothoros.
So everyone's right.
I like Sothoros.
Yeah.
That's good. Do you guys call it Aswath or?
No.
No, I might start though.
Yeah.
I forget what the other one is now. It's completely gone out of my mind. I guess before we go, I want to know what everyone thinks that Leighton Hightower is up to in the Hightower.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about this last night.
Well, it's funny because I wasn't really talking about Leighton. I was talking about
the Mad Maid.
No, his sons, because they're, you know, so they're coming and then they get kind of like the rundown of Leighton and Melora are up in the Hightower, but all the sons are doing things. They each have a job. One guy's gathering men, one guy's doing the harbor. One of them, Humphrey, has gone off to Lys to hire cell sails.
Different from swords.
Sell sails, which is definitely a different thing. And, you know, he's supposed to try to get Lynas, their sister, who is Jor's wife, who lives in Lys now with her lover.
Whoa. Forgot about that connection.
I know. It's a weird, we were talking about it last
really
night.
Strange.
Like, that's Jor's wife, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So he's going to ask for her help. But the way they talk about her, it seems like it's not, you know, they don't have a lot of faith that she's going to help them. So I was saying, look, he's looking for cell swords and he sails to Lys. His sister's like, tells him to go pound sand and he's on his way back. And where is there just a big fleet of cell sails just kind of sitting there waiting to come back into the story? Orain Waters is in the Stepstones. And we've talked a lot about him recently because we've been kind of in around that whole, you know, Dorne and the Stormlands and everything. And, you know, I have this feeling that he's eventually going to end up with Aegon.
Hmm.
But as we talked about this a bit last night after we read the chapter and we were making some notes. And what if Humphrey Hightower ends up hiring Orion Waters and brings him over? And that actually is how he gets drawn back into the story. And then if the whole Friends in the Reach thing happens, that could be a way for him to actually ultimately end up with Aegon. If, you know, some of the Reach Lords end up on Aegon's side because Cersei has abandoned them to, that's their perspective right now, is that she's abandoned them to the Ironborn.
That would be way less mystical than people are afraid that the direction that they're going.
Yeah.
And it would be way less sort of throwing up your hands and giving up than it seems like is happening.
But as in you asked, but so that is a total side jog from the question you asked, which is what is Leighton Hightower doing? And I have no clue.
Yeah, no clue.
No clue. He's
for
up there.
For once, I'm speechless.
Does he have a glass cannon?
Right.
I don't know.
Well, to be up there for a decade, is that how long it was? Or 10 years or some really long time that he's been kind of locked up in
his But in when his you think space. About it, I looked, so the height of the Hightower is like, what did we say? Like 70 stories. It's like, it's insane. It's a skyscraper and they don't have elevators.
It's too hard to get down.
So exactly. I mean, if I was him and I was up there, I would be like, no, yeah. I'm
what
not
about
going
the wall
down there.
Lift? You got to put like a version of the wall lift in there, right?
There's got to be something. Well, to bring food up there too.
Unless you have a really good, I'm going to call them servants. Unless you have really good servants with like a handoff system.
God, I'm sorry.
Do you need to call someone?
No, it's just because it's my phone continues to feed me the notifications if I don't look at them.
Is there anything happening that we missed
no,
in the world?
It was me trying to ignore something that did not want to be ignored. Sorry.
So you guys don't know. I don't know either. I felt like it seemed like someone throwing up their hands and being like, I don't know what to do. I hope
let somebody else be in charge. Exactly. I'm going to go quote unquote figure it out.
Me too.
Just kind of runs away.
I just felt like he's up there and he doesn't want to come down.
But his kids might be the saving grace.
Maybe. I feel like his sons are actually being proactive. I mean, I don't know what will happen with Melora, who's, you know, she's been set up to be kind of a mysterious figure. But does that ever, you know, does it ever come to mean anything in the story? I don't know, because of all the stuff
sometimes
we were just talking about, you know, like there's so much story to tell with all the characters we already have. How do you meaningfully add new characters?
Right. All these randos, no offense to them.
Yeah. No offense, but...
Sorry, Mad Maid. You're kind of a rando at this point.
We don't have time for you. That's the way I see it, but I'm the wrong person to ask.
Yeah.
I don't have time for like 85% of the characters in the Song of Ice and Fire.
Want to go to Owns?
Yeah, let's do Owns.
Let's do it.
I've already said my own like 7 times, so I feel like it's time for me to definitively put it out there.
Do it.
I'm going to give my own 2... that exchange between Leo and Sam and Marwyn, where he says, I'm Sam from Horn Hill, Lord Randall Tarly's son. Are you still a craven? No, lied Sam. John had made it a command. I went beyond the wall and fought in battles. They call me Sam the Slayer. He did not know why he said it. The words just tumbled out. Leo laughed, and before he could reply, the door opened behind him. Get in here, Slayer, growled the man in the doorway. I just like that whole exchange because as we talk so much about his transformation, so much of being in Leo's presence, it says it makes him feel like he was still a boy of 7 about to wet his small clothes, just being around somebody that he kind of grew up around, hearing of, and then he tumbles out that he's Sam the Slayer because he can't keep it in.
Yeah, all the trauma. He's just like that, like abused little boy that is just like, I gotta say something cool.
Mm-hmm. He's really
killed someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's caught between the past and the future, isn't he?
Totally.
Like he really wants to be this person, but things keep pulling him back. And in this case, Leo, you know, just makes him feel 7 years old again.
Thought it was such a great moment. So,
and he's someone that he knew when he was 7.
Yeah,
it's not just the feeling. Yeah,
yeah.
I was going to give my own to the audacity of having all access to everything and using it to look up naked girls, but it reminds me too much of the real world. So I'm going to skip that one for my own. And I want to give it to George for the sphinxes in this chapter, the sphinxes outside of, I forget the building, but the two, the male and female sphinxes, giving me more confusion. Is that the riddle of the Riddler? To Alaris, obviously, but also just to the idea of the, when Eamon said that, I was just like, oh, light me on fire. You know, like, this is what I need. More of this. He's saying all this other stuff, and then you say that, and it made me think of, I have this strange thought that he's also multi-purpose mentioning this, the idea of the Sphinx coming from our own world history of this strange object that can either be the riddle or the person. It can be this weird thing asking you the riddle, as sphinxes have been adapted from mythology, I'm assuming from that structure. I don't know, but I don't know which came first, but it seems like the Sphinx is one of the oldest things that we have. So I'm going to go ahead and say it's probably that thing. But I think that its existence is the riddle. It's like, well, what is it?
Right.
Why is it? How long has it been here? Who made it? Yeah. All those questions that come along with that, I feel like he's sort of implanting into the story through this Sorella character. And then also I found there to be more confusion in my heart because they were outside of this building. Again, not for an accidental purpose. So I'm going to continue to dig into it. But I just think it's really neat that it seems like he thinks the right stuff about the Sphinx, because that's sort of intuitively how I feel about it, because there's so much confusion. And I think that that sort of a worldly point of view is very intellectual, because that's as smart as I can come up with. Maybe there's a better way to look at it, but I think that to any well-organized mind, that the Sphinx is a riddle. You don't know the answer. It just is. What is that?
Yeah.
Like, we don't know the answer. Right. I just thought for him to put it in the story was really, really cool.
Really cool.
All right, Radio Westeros.
Okay.
Get these owns.
My own is to Jaqen for masquerading as Pate and then spying on probably the most important conversation in the history of the Seven Kingdoms and just scoring big time for the faceless men.
Congrats to him.
Yeah.
Nice job.
Yeah. Well, mine is, I've already mentioned mine too. Mine is Sam and his arrow proving all the haters wrong. Everybody that called him, you know, a craven and useless and someone who could never, you know, get out of his own way and was afraid of his own shadow. He fired that arrow. He stood there and he fired that arrow at the terrifying Ironborn and hit his mark. So go Sam.
Go Sam.
Maybe he won't be ironically the Slayer later. Maybe he'll actually be the Slayer. Like,
really, maybe he'll own it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now we'll go on to your owns. The first one comes from Ali Levine on Instagram, who says, this chapter has a lot of setup for the hellscape Old Town is about to become in the Winds of Winter. So without giving my own to the obvious Alaris, Marwyn, or Pate, I'm going to give my own to Maester Aemon for being the oldest BAMF in Westeros. Alaris mentioned that he could have taught the world more about his father Kingmaker, but I would have liked to know more about Aemon himself. He would have made a great king, it seems, so I wonder why he wasn't willing to set aside his vows. I wonder what he knows about Bloodraven in his time before, during, and after the Wall. I wonder what other deep mysteries he could shed light on. It's true that he saw so much history during a really tumultuous time in Westeros, and I bet he was a certified hottie with a body in his day.
Yeah.
Also, head nod to the Sphinx being representative of both male and female. Yes, we see you, Alarius the River, the Riddler.
There you go.
There's the connection I was looking for. Thank you, Allie.
There you go. Thanks, Allie.
And from Katie Young. Own to Maester Aemon for being known as the oldest man in Westeros. Not an easy feat. Maester Aemon taking it home.
No, Maester Aemon really getting it. If you want to send in your own, if you have your own thoughts and feelings, you can do that in a couple of different ways. You can find us on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook by searching for Game of Owns, or you can send us an email to contact@gameofowns.com.
We have OnlyFans. We have Patreon, where we post extra content. That's behind a paywall that you would love to see. Maybe. Check it out. Patreon.com/goo. Got a squad of Ice and Fire. I'm probably going to record one of those after this really quick with Matt and Jen. It's going to be fun. I just thought about it just now. So that'll be fun. What else? That's it. That's all. Oh, I'm doing a solo read through on there where I just read the chapter And then I talked to myself. So I started at the beginning of Game of Thrones.
I wasn't a good enough conversation. Are you good company?
I don't think so. It's like looking in a mirror too long. It's a little weird, but you eventually block it out. And if I get to where I'm doing enough of them, then it's easier. But the longer I wait, the harder it is.
Where can people find you guys? And what are you up to next?
You can find us at RadioWesteros.com. We also have a Patreon, so you can find us there. You can find us on YouTube, Radio Westeros, or wherever you get your fine podcasts. What we're up to now is we've been doing our Winds of Winter Primer series. We're about to release our 8th episode in that series. We've been going kind of region by region and grouping up characters. So this one is about the Reach. It's about Sam and Euron. No, I'm sorry. That's our current episode.
Yeah,
I can see my partner shaking his head at me.
We've moved on to Slaver's Bay. So we're talking about Victarion and Tyrion. And what's going around Slaver's Bay, which sellswords are fighting for who? Those catapults, the hostages, all that complicated stuff. We've sort of ironed it out and we can give you a presentation and get you up to scratch for the Winds of Winter, which is going to come out pretty soon, guys. Honest.
Hey, we have two more forays into this primer, and then Winds of Winter is going to be right there.
Yeah, we
right
have work to do, too.
At
we
the
don't.
End of it. So,
you know, take a little bit longer.
Yeah, we need like 3 or 4 more months.
Yeah.
It will be done.
That How many years have you guys been doing this?
2014.
Yeah,
right, 7 years. 2014. Actually, a couple of weeks, it will be our 7-year anniversary.
Wow,
we
congratulations.
We started with an episode about the Mercy chapter not long after that was released. And
the rest is history.
The rest is history, literally. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
I've been looking forward to this for such a long time.
It's great to do this in person after being apart from people for so long. Just to be in the same room is great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It really is. And
I've
been wanting to have you on the show for so long too. And we've had Lady Gwen on the show multiple times, but we were like, whenever you came back into the podcast game after your move, we were like, it was a self-imposed isolation from you. I was like, I don't want to have you on the podcast until we can hang out in person and
get the full experience,
do the full thing. And this, for me, this conversation has not been a disappointment. It's exactly what I hoped it would be. Probably one of my favorite that I've had on the show so far.
Thank you
guys for having us in your house.
Thank you for being here.
Talking to us about all this in-game stuff that none of us know the answer to. This is really fun.
Yeah.
Thanks everybody for listening.
One last plug.
Yes.
If you want to follow along on a reading order with us, and if you want to read the next chapter, we're going to do the epilogue from A Dance of Dragons. And you can find that reading order at afeastofdragons.com.
That's it.
That's all I got.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks,
this was
everyone.
Fun.